walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Must be an animal. Come hear the animals. Talking animals. Talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is John W. James, co-author of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. Having founded the Grief Recovery Institute some 30-plus years ago, James's tremendous experience and expertise in helping people who've been affected by losses of every kind. And in this book, he shares that knowledge focused on coping with the loss of a pet, including major myths about grieving and specific measures to heal. This is information that could affect millions and millions of people each year. An estimated 43 million people in this country grieve each year over the loss of a cat or a dog. And when you add the deaths of exotic pets and other animals, that figure rises to upwards of 63 million new pet loss grievers in the U.S. every year. We'll speak with John W. James in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, we'll speak briefly with Matt Ellerbeck, a salamander advocate who will inform us about a deadly fungus that is rapidly spreading across Europe, and a petition has been created to halt the import of salamanders into the U.S. unless first screened for that fungus. Before I go any further, a couple of important programming notes. First, starting 1 week from today, January 21st, Talking Animals will be broadcast an hour later, airing at 10 a.m. Also, 3 weeks from today, February 4th, WNS Winter Membership Drive will have already begun, and I'll be on air that morning raising money for the station on Talking Animals. As usual, I'll have pretty cool Talking Animals only thank you gifts for donations of various levels, including a pair of killer tickets to see The Who kick off their tour, The Who Hits 50, right here in Tampa, and a pair of insanely good tickets to see Lewis Black at the Straz, in a package that includes a meet and greet with the fiery comedian and Daily Show fixture who recently appeared on Meet the Press. And I know these tickets will be fantastic because I'm arranging them directly with Lewis himself. Plus, I'll be offering as thank yous pocket monkeys. These are not, of course, actual animals, but an ultra-thin, ultra-cool 12-in-1 tool. More on that, the pocket monkey, next week. Meanwhile, if you want to get a jump on these red-hot tickets to The Hugh or Lewis Black, email Duncan at WMNF.org. Either way, if you're a fan of Talking Animals and the work we do here each Wednesday, I hope you'll consider making an early donation. How about today? Either through the Talking Animals tip jar found in the Talking Animals page on WMNF.org, or again, you can contact me about a donation at WMNF.org. Thanks for any support you can send my way. So now, for our opening animal song this morning, we'll hear something new from Andrew Bird, suggested by the fabulous Nancy C, who gets double points, an animal tune by a guy named Bird. This is Frog Singing from Andrew Bird now on Talking Animals.
Have you ever seen a fish jumping off from a quiet stream? Shine a moment in the light, fall away again. Have you seen it, brother? Won't you come outside and see? Have you ever seen the rain turn the earth to mud? Watch the mud turn gold in the rising sun. Come outside and see. Won't you come with me tonight, down to the lowland fields, to hear the frogs singing in the air so hot and still? Won't you come with me, sister? Won't you come with me tonight?
That's Andrew Bird with Frogs Singing, a jaunty animal song to get us launched this morning. Let's move now into our conversation with John W. James, co-author of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing us at dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome John W. James to Talking Animals. Good morning, John.
And good morning, Duncan.
Thanks for joining us on Talking Animals this morning. Bright and early, I know, from where you're speaking, so I appreciate it all the more.
Well, I live on a ranch, so I've already been up feeding horses and dogs and cats and all kinds of things.
Oh, good. Okay, great. Well, then I still appreciate you being with us now, even if it's not quite the sacrifice I might have imagined. So now, before we explore the book and some of the grief recovery guidance it offers, let's establish a bit of context. Grief isn't typically a field that people pursue as a career path. How did you find your way there?
Well, that's what is true for me, I think, is true for everyone who works in this area, and that is, it's not an intellectual decision that you make. I mean, you don't wake up one morning and think, oh, grief, what an idea, I'll devote 40 years of my life to it. What happened is I had a son die in 1977, and following that loss, I was dumbfounded at the way my wife and I were treated. The things that people said that seemed to be insensitive or off-topic and that kind of thing. And so I did a whole bunch of research. And back then, research meant, you know, getting in the car and driving down to the library and, you know, digging around in dusty stacks and so forth, because there was no internet or any of that. And so quite by accident or trial and error, I discovered a process that helped me to feel better, and never dreamed, of course, that it would be of any value to anyone else. And now 37 years later and 6 continents later and 5 books, and, you know, we discovered that the grief recovery method, the process of completing that which is emotionally unfinished at the time of the loss, works for all loss, and it works for all people. So we're really thrilled about that, and we're really thrilled about this book, because pet loss, the grief caused by pet loss, is by far and away, in volume, the largest loss in North America.
Yeah, I just, at the opening of the show, I rattled off some of the statistics, and the numbers are just staggering. So, yeah, I want to, of course, obviously explore the book and the method you just referred to, but how, when you say you sort of were surprised to find that what really helped you, and then all these years later, 30 plus years later, was there something about your background or your life at that moment beyond the finally getting the help that you and your wife need that was sorely lacking before you began that research and that path, that compelled you to react to your own healing by deciding, hey, I'm going to help others similarly heal?
Well, that's kind of interesting. I really got started in trying to find a way to feel better myself, to keep from ending my life. Death of a child, of course, is very, very devastating. And we, as a society of people, don't give anyone any tools for dealing with grief. I mean, I don't know if it's still true, but back when I was in high school, everyone had to take a class in health and safety, first aid, and so forth in order to graduate from high school. So if somebody fell down, broke their arm, you know, or had a physical injury of some kind, everybody had some knowledge about what to do. But never was I introduced in grade school or high school or college, or never was I introduced to a topic on what do you do when your heart is broken. And so, again, it was, I struggled to find some ways to identify what it was that was causing all this pain. And I did that. And then after I kind of helped myself, I just sat back and thought to myself, well, that's really great, and I'm grateful for it, and so on, and never did another thing with it. And a few weeks later, a friend of mine brought a couple to my office, and they had just had a child die. And he walked in and he said, listen, these people have come to me for help and I don't know what to do, but I know you've had this experience. Will you talk to them? And I said, well, my first thought, now here's some truth for you. My first thought was, no, I don't want to talk to them. It might bring all that pain. You know. And then I thought, oh, I remember how alone I felt. And so I thought, well, come on, bring them in. And I will never forget them. They sat across my desk. This was in Culver City, California at the time. And they came back every day for 6 days. And we spent like an hour and a half doing the very same things that I had done that proved to be helpful for me. And they were helped. And then within the next year and a half or so, it got to the point where almost 50% of my day was spent talking to people who had been sent to me. And so that's when I thought, well, you know, there's a lot of people out there who are hurting. And so maybe I can kind of get busy helping them. And it's really interesting. Helping people is very compelling. It's the rewards to you as an individual are enormous.
Yeah.
In terms of helping people.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think when people look at any area of that kind of work, yeah, there's a certain altruism to it. But often, of course, the person providing that help is gleaning often at least as much.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I can remember, boy, you're taking me on a trip down memory lane here. I can remember thinking, what is my goal here? And the goal was to deliver grief recovery assistance to the largest number of people in the shortest period of time. And so, I mean, in terms of no matter how many people I was going to help one-on-one, it was never going to be very many. And so in 1984, I started writing Grief Recovery Handbook, and it was published in 86, and now it's almost 30 years ago, and that book is a HarperCollins book. It's, I forget how many printings now. It's in its fourth edition, translated into 17 languages. It's available worldwide. We train people now to become grief recovery specialists, and they go back to their local communities and help grievers locally through their church or through the pet industry now, because we have the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. And so it has grown into this gigantic thing. And now, of course, I'm old, and so I'm happy that the young people let me still have a desk at the office.
Well, and it sounds like you really answered your early question about how can I help as many people as possible recover from their grief, and I can meet with these folks in my office, but until you wrote the book, it sounds like, I mean, if you go to the website, the griefrecoverymethod.com website, it's interesting to me that one of the first two things, major things you see is, of course, ways that you could get help if you're there to get help with your own grief recovery, but almost sort of an equal position is how to become someone who could help people recover from their grief.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting, because people, one of the myths about grief or grief recovery is that I can heal myself by keeping busy. And very large numbers of people try to help themselves by keeping busy by helping others, but they have no tools with which to do that. But even before we get off on that a little further, on the website there, one of the little tag buttons up there says helpful articles and blogs and so forth. And we have, you know, 30 years of articles, blogs, interviews, and so on and so forth that are absolutely, utterly free for people to download and read and, you know, to familiarize themselves with the experience they're having and with what they can do about it. We're not helpless here. There's things that you can do to heal your heart But the problem, of course, is as we talked about earlier, we're not told or taught those tools. Everybody listening, I'm sure, at one time or another has heard, oh, time heals all wounds. Well, it doesn't. It never did, and it never will. You see, but we keep passing that piece of information along from one generation to the next as if it were true.
Yeah, well, you know, John, that's really interesting because we're sort of getting into grieving myths, which is among the things that are notable to the grief recovery method overall and certainly, therefore, a guiding principle of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. So, yeah, so let's talk a little bit about that because I have to say I have more than a little experience with loss and grief, and I definitely learned some things from the book, and it certainly made me reassess others. And one of those you just cited, for example, I have sort of both embraced and, when appropriate, I guess, counseled people in that give it time way. Right. And it has seemed that when dealing with painful periods, obviously including loss, the time is your ally. So I felt that before and I've said that before. So maybe you could explain how and why that's wrong or why that's actually a myth for grieving.
Well, let's say that what it is half of the information. So let's say this morning you walk out of the radio studio there and the left front tire of your car is flat. Would you sit down on the curb and just wait for time to put air back in your tire? And the answer is, of course not. Now, what would you do? You'd come out and within time, you would take action to solve the problem. You know, you'd open the trunk, get out the spare and whatever, or you'd call the auto club or whatever. But you would be taking appropriate action within time. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Absolutely,
so
yeah.
So recovery from loss indeed takes some time, but it isn't the time alone that helps you. It is the actions that I'm taking within time. Now, when we say to someone, oh, just give it some time and so on, the thing that happens most is memory fades, and so they do indeed appear to look better. They sound better, that kind of thing. But inside, that kernel of sadness is still there, and it negatively affects future choices and future decisions. I forget the most recent statistic with pet owners who have the death of a pet. Somewhere close to 60% of them never get another pet. And it's not because they stop liking pets. It's because the thought of having another pet brings up all the pain that is unfinished from the previous one.
Well, that brings us, I think, then to another grieving myth, which is replace the loss, which, of course, is highly germane to our conversation and this show. So first of all, maybe you could just explain by what you mean by replace the loss, and especially in regards to that statistic that you just cited, because I think it's vitally important for people listening to this show to say, well, how does one identify the right time to adopt a new animal after the loss of a pet? For those people, I'm surprised that the number is that high of people who never do.
First time I heard that number, I think I was doing a talk at the Pennsylvania Veterinarians Convention, and I went, oh my goodness, and did a little research and talked to some of the dog food companies and so on, and sure enough, it's an enormous number. Now, it may have changed over the last 10 years and so on, but let's go back to replace the loss. The things that you really need to understand is that when we are grieving the end of an emotional relationship, and no two are the same. So every relationship is unique, okay? Therefore, every griever is unique. So let's say we have a dog that dies, or a cat, or a horse, or whatever. It affects everybody in the family, but differently, because their emotional relationship was unique. Now, when we go to replace the loss, I mean, I've even seen people go out and try to get the same breed of dog, and to get a dog with exactly the same markings, and so on. And they're trying to replace the relationship, and that can't be done. Most people who have more pets than one will notice immediately that no two of them are the same either. We have four dogs, and every one of them has a different personality, and they have different little traits and so on. So the important issue is I must grieve and complete what is unfinished emotionally in the relationship before I go and get another pet. In other words, you can't say hello to the new until you first say goodbye to the old.
Let me quickly follow that up in one second. Let me just let you know, so this is Talking Animals. If you just tune in, my guest is John W. James, co-author of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. If you'd like to ask John a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So here's in terms of the last thing you said, John, I mean, one question is, okay, so let's say I've just lost a dog, and I'm sorting out when the right time for me is to replace that dog, and hopefully I've done the proper grieving. But how do I not only safeguard against welcoming a new pet too soon, but the other important point you made is if I'm part of a family and everybody had a unique relationship with that dog who just died, how do we then also sort out from person to person when is too soon or when is the right time?
Well, the process that is laid out in the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss can, in fact, be done as a family. Okay? So a teenage girl's relationship with the family dog is going to be different than mom's relationship with the family dog or dad's relationship. They're going to have had different conversations with this pet. It's interesting, too. Again, this goes way back to the 90s. One of the things we tried to research, which is impossible to do, so everything I'm about to tell you it would fall into the category of anecdotal research, which sometimes I think is the most valuable, actually. One of the things we discovered is that the most honest emotional conversations that take place in the world take place between a pet owner and their pet. And then the question is, well, why is this true? And it is because pets don't judge. I mean, if you came home today and you've had the worst day of your whole life, you know, and you walk in the house, the dog wags the tail, licks your face, and starts to negotiate a place at the table for dinner, okay? Now, the next day you come home, it's the best day you ever had in your whole life, and you come home, and what does the dog do? Wags his tail, licks your face, and starts to negotiate a place at the table. Not one time has your pet ever looked at you and said, or thought, or wagged its finger at you and said, oh, you should have done better. Oh, you should lose that 15 pounds. Oh, you're just so silly. You see, they are the safest emotional place in our environment. And then the problem is we kind of forget to tell them the truth about what they've meant to us. And then it's only after the loss that I begin to think, oh, I wish I'd have done differently. I wish I'd have done that better. I wish I had known more, and so on. And those are the kernels of incomplete loss. I don't want to keep going on this.
I think it's really helpful because I think on the one hand, what you just described about the way they don't wag their fingers and they don't tell you to lose the 15 pounds and everything else that goes with that. I mean, for a lot of people, depending on their background, family history, makeup, whatever. I mean, those are profound emotional relationships, and therefore the loss is just so powerful and devastating for those very reasons. So I think, we don't have probably time to explore in detail creating the pet loss history graph and the steps involved in reviewing your relationship and the completion letter. I mean, that's what the book is for, I suppose. But maybe you could sort of briefly describe each, because I think I'm sure a lot of people are listening either, of course, have gone through that experience, maybe on the cusp of going through it. And even, like I say, in my case, I've certainly gone through it, but there's some things I would do differently, and even that I would go back in the wake of reading this book and do even about animals that I've lost some years ago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the first exercises is a kind of a loss history graph for pet. Like my first pet, I think I was 6 years old when my first pet died, and so on and so on and so on. The one that would immediately pop up, follow this, even though there may be a more recent loss, one of the losses on that loss chart is going to present itself as the biggest one. And for me, it was a dog that died back in 1984 that literally saved my life emotionally. I mean, I came from a kind of a dysfunctional alcoholic home growing up, so I learned to stuff feelings early. I'm a Vietnam veteran, which means I learned to stuff feelings professionally, okay, yeah. And so on and so on.
Yeah.
And I had not shed a tear, not one, since I was 9 years old until the day this dog died. And I started to cry. And, of course, was embarrassed because, oh, my God, big guys don't cry and all that foolishness. And after about 2 minutes of kind of weeping, it dawned on me that not only was I crying for this dog who died, I was crying for all of the other losses that, you know, where I had stuffed those feelings. And that really opened a door to me of, you have been carrying around baggage with you, that there has to be a better way of dealing with it other than carrying it around like a bag of rocks. So you're never really sure what you're going to discover when you get involved in this process. But for most people, it is the most recent loss that is causing them the most pain, in effect, because it is recent.
I was going to say, it's interesting that what you're describing and being so profound was some 7 years or so after your son died and after kind of all the path that you traveled, created and figured out the grief recovery method and started helping others on a larger scale. So it's just interesting that maybe because it was an animal, that even 7 years into that whole journey of yours, that still you had such a profound revelation on the death of that dog.
Yeah, see, and it's funny. My story is not unique. Everybody has a story, you see. And most of the time, we're all very comfortable talking about the objective, physical, intellectual parts. What we are not comfortable with is acknowledging the emotional content of a relationship. I mean, if owning a pet was strictly an objective intellectual event, nobody would own a pet because it's a bad deal financially. Okay? I mean, I have 3 rescue horses, and trust me, the bill for hay and the bill for vet and so forth is high.
Sure.
Okay? But I don't keep the pets, I don't keep the horses because of the physical, intellectual part. We have them, they're wonderful, wonderful creatures, and they understand being in the moment, and they understand, I mean, I can carry my year-and-a-half-old grandson right out to the pasture, and they will come up, and they are the most gentle and the most loving, and you know, and these are rescue horses. These are horses that were abused that we acquired. So it's the emotional part that is the key to having a pet.
And really, of course, the corollary to that is that when you lose one, how you really grieve that, and that seems to be really kind of the crux or a crux of the method and especially this book, is what you're really going to do and how you're going to really address that history with that pet. And an important thing that, again, people can find out more if they choose to get the book is writing a letter and noting some things that maybe you as the human could have done better, apologizing for some, forgiving the animal for things that may have happened along the way. And those are the kind of things that really then do allow you to grieve and become
complete.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, and before the clock runs out on us, I want to make sure 2 things. Number one, anybody who has any need for further information, griefrecoverymethod.com. Go to the website. We get 1 million hits there a month. You're not going to overwhelm us, okay? And the last thing I want to say for sure to you, Duncan, is thank you for having the courage to have the topic of grief on your show. So many people in the media go, oh, that's a downer, man. We don't want that on the air.
Yeah.
You see? And yet it is, next to breathing, I think, the most predictable thing on earth is loss.
Absolutely. And again, as we've, as a through line of this conversation, is that it's, I mean, if you're in the throes of it, it's very intense and focused and tangible. But if you're not at that moment in the grip of it, it's elusive and it's sort of hard to sort out. And you said a lot of the information about it is almost necessarily anecdotal. So if you're not sharing information about it, and if there's, you know, a new book to be read about it that's helpful, I mean, it seems like that's crucial for for people who, again, if we love animals, you know, unless you have a particular kind of bird, they're not going to outlive you. You're going to go through loss and maybe multiple losses, depending what kind of animals you like and how long you've been an animal person. So it seems crucial to explore this, even if it's not the most cheery topic. But in a way, it actually is, because it'll help a lot of people who are sad and struggling now or later do feel much better at a pivotal time.
Absolutely. Couldn't have said that any better myself.
All right. Well, maybe we'll co-write the next one. But so
there you go.
Yeah, because that's the thing, you know, it's funny, while I was reading your book, John, I should point out too that you have two co-authors, Russell Friedman and then your son Cole James, just that we spoke, just want to speak kind of one-on-one. But you know, at the same time, just a few days ago, there was a New York Times piece, it was a blog piece or an opinion piece, I forget, calling Getting Grief Right. And this was a psychotherapist writing about his patient. It was an accountant who had lost her daughter to sudden infant death syndrome, and was driven and uptight, and I'd already been to two other therapists at least. And among the things that was notable and why she was struggling is at some point she even either said specifically, or he sort of paraphrased, that she felt her grief was, and recovery from it, was behind schedule. And I thought, well, this really encapsulates a lot of what we don't understand. Again, if especially if it's a sudden loss and a kid, you're going to be even more sort of just thrown off your rails. But I just thought this, it dovetailed with kind of reading your book, and I just thought, wow, it is such a difficult topic to understand, and anything that can help people, you know, with some insights and methods is so critical.
Well, and it's interesting too, because there's no timetable.
Yeah.
So when somebody says, gee, I think I'm behind, that may be true for them as an individual, but it means nothing to the person standing right next to them. Remember, every relationship is unique. Therefore, every griever is unique. And so it's not, oh, gee, it takes 3 days and 12 minutes, or it's just not the way it is.
Well, that's the other thing. Another of the myth that's critical kind of to the method is don't feel bad. I mean, people say, hey, don't feel bad. And especially when it's the animal thing, as you point out a few times in the book, people say, don't feel bad. And hey, we'll go get a new puppy on Saturday. It's like, whoa, you got a couple of sort of erroneous things mixed together there in a combination of disaster.
Those pieces of incorrect information work together. See, the idea would be, just keep busy, meaning if I just move fast enough and so forth, I won't feel the feelings I'm feeling. But hidden underneath the keep busy is, if enough time passes, remember, it just takes time, if enough time passes, somehow, magically, I will feel better. Well, none of that is going to happen unless you have a systematic process that you can follow to identify the little arrows that are stuck in your heart so that you can pull them out and complete them. And, I mean, we get so many questions about pet loss. It's, when is the time to get a new pet? Well, once you have finished the grief recovery method, then almost intuitively, you will know. Plus, people who have to, you know, in the next few days, few weeks, few months, there are people listening to the show who are going to have to euthanize their pet. It is far better to be emotionally complete with your pet before he or she dies. You see, there they can read the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss and identify all the stuff that is incomplete or unfinished right now and finish it before the vet comes to the house or however this happens. And that's just in the case of illness, because we have so many runaway pets, and we've had, particularly since the economy went bad, we've had so many people who've had to surrender pets. And this is devastating stuff we're talking about here.
Right. Yeah. And so, we should note that loss, of course, encompasses all those things. The animal may not have died, but it may be a loss to you in one form or another, and all these principles still apply. Again, I'm speaking with John W. James, co-author of The Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss. We're in our final moment or two, but we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. I'm going to read a couple of emails just because I think they really speak to a lot of issues that we've been sort of addressing so far. One says, hi, not really a question, but I really beat myself up on my dog, who virtually had been my sister when everywhere with me, died shortly after my grandmother died. And I felt Fanny's death so much more strongly than my granny's that I just felt guilty. So, yeah.
Very common.
Yeah.
Again, guilt, of course, is not the right word, but we don't have time to get into that. But what is the difference between all the people that she had relationships with and the pet. And the relationship with the pet was non-judgmental. You see, not, you know, Granny or whoever probably said to her once upon a time, oh, you should study harder, or so on and so on. Dog, cat, whatever it was, they don't do that. They just accept you and love you. And that is a really fabulous gift. It's too bad more of us humans can't learn that one.
For sure.
But apparently we're slow learners.
Yeah, but we're getting there. But so here's another email. The subject line is, fantastic guest says, thank you for talking about this. So many people don't understand how sad it is to lose a pet. And one thing we haven't touched on in this show, but I've touched on a number of times in other shows, because I think part of the very problem, well, you've touched actually on it indirectly, but people who aren't animal people, who cannot for the life of them understand why you're so upset. Hey, it's just a dog, or whatever they might say.
Well, they always precede that by saying, oh, don't feel bad. It was only a pet.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And it's so interesting. The worst thing that you can possibly say to someone is, I know how you feel. So let me give you a better tip. So the next time you're out there and you run into somebody who's had a pet walk, pet die, say instead, I can't imagine how you are feeling. And then close your mouth and open your ears, and they will tell you how they're feeling. And then if you're trying to help, don't judge. You didn't have the relationship that they had with the pet who died. Remember, every relationship is unique. You see, we have a lot of work to do as it relates to pet loss and grief.
For sure. Here's something, another email, and then we may try to squeeze in a call. We're running a little over time here, but this I just think is so important for people to hear and respond. This says, Duncan, yeah, I was in the category of quote-unquote no more after having to put down my domestic long-haired cat, Pete. After he got feline leukemia, we were together for 14 years, three states, and many adventures. His parting really slayed me, and I thought, never again. And I was living with that conviction when a six-month-old domestic short hair came to my front door one day, about a dozen years after Pete, after insisting that she go away, ended up taking her in, and now had Bunny for 15 years. Needless to say, I'm not looking forward to her passing, but I have no regrets for my decision. None.
Well, at the 15-year mark, I would encourage that person to get a copy of the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Law and start identifying all the stuff that is unfinished before the pet dies. You see? It won't be as devastating.
Yeah, no, I mean, those of us who haven't lost or aren't losing animals through, God forbid, an accident or being hit by, something very sudden and unexpected. Yeah, I really, among the many things I got from this book was the importance of when you reasonably would think, hey, it may be time, not necessarily next week or next month, but to really start some of those techniques so that, yeah, when the time does come, you're much better prepared and your grief is, you can recover from it more readily because you've already begun. So.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, John. Well, we unfortunately have gone a little over our time, but I think well worth it, and I think such valuable information. This has been speaking with John W. James. It's the Grief Recovery Handbook for Pet Loss, the book that we've been discussing, and the website for all kinds of information and all the blog posts and material that John referred to is griefrecoverymethod.com. John, thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals.
Thank you. Call us anytime.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. In a moment, we'll have a brief chat with Salamander advocate Matt Ellerbeck about an important matter that needs our attention and a petition that needs our signatures. Right now, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner. This is a very short piece from Maria Bamford with a piece called Vegetarian Oscar Schindler on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I wish I could be a vegetarian, because I've seen all the horrible videos of those animals, you know. Pigs lined up in front of their children and shot at close. I haven't seen that, but I imagine that's what I could never watch those videos. It looks so scary. But I would like to think that I'd be an Oscar Schindler in the face of a systematic genocide. But first they came for the ice cream cones, and I said nothing. Because I was not an ice cream cone. All right.
That was Maria Bamford with a piece called Vegetarian Oscar Schindler, taken from her album, Ask Me About My New God. Right now, to discuss an important matter about salamanders, let's welcome Matt Ellerbeck back to Talking Animals. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. Let's quickly step back just briefly to the kind of remedial level. Remind us for a moment exactly what salamanders are.
Salamanders are amphibians, just like frogs and toads. And although they look like lizards, they're their own distinct group of animals. And a really easy way to tell a lizard apart from a salamander is lizards are dry and scaly, and they have claws on their feet, while salamanders have moist, soft-looking skin, and they have no claws, and they have no scales.
So now let's get to the sort of heart of the matter. What's going on at the moment? What is this fungus? And let's start there.
Well, before I get to that, I just want to briefly mention that, you know, salamanders are one of the most at-risk groups of animals in the world, with over half of all species at risk of extinction. So they're already very much imperiled, and now they have this new threat in the form of a fungus. And so what's going on is the Center for Biological Diversity has launched a new petition to urge the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to halt the import of all salamanders into the country. The U.S. has more salamander species than anywhere else in the world, with over 150 different forms. So America is really the hot spot for salamanders. And that's why we don't want to have any imports coming in, because they can introduce this new fungus called B-Sal, which has been spreading like wildfire across Europe, and through imports could enter America. Now, this fungus has a mortality rate of 96%, so it's nearly 100% fatality. It's practically wiped out fire salamanders in the Netherlands, and lab tests have shown that it is fatal to American salamanders. So if it did enter the country, it would be a huge conservation concern. And that's why they're calling on the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to halt the import of salamanders into the country. Now, for listeners that want to help out, they're still collecting petitions or signatures for the petition. And you can find it on my Facebook group called Save the Salamanders. So if you just look up Save the Salamanders, it's pinned right at the top. So it's the first thing you'll see when you go on. And it's really important that U.S. residents, you know, sign this and support it, because, you know, this is an American matter.
And Matt, what are the prospects for that petition pushing through the kind of prevention of, or the safeguards for salamanders coming in being checked for that fungus?
I think it's very positive. The Center for Biological Diversity, you know, has really stepped up and tried to push through a lot of really important issues. So I think it's a really great starting place. So I think I feel quite positive about it, and that's why I really encourage people, you know, to get active and support this, because I think it does have the prospect to do a lot of good.
And obviously it's an urgent matter, because I guess the sooner that this would be enacted, the better protections there would be for salamanders to not be exposed to or spread the fungus.
Absolutely. And also, when you're on the Facebook page as well, there's also a link back to SaveTheSalamanders.com, and there's lots of other things on there. There's a whole How You Can Help section for what people can do. I'm a big believer, and, you know, I don't like to spread doom and gloom. Obviously, when we're talking about animals and endangered species, there is, you know, tons of horrible issues going on. But I think the most important thing is empowering people and getting, you know, individuals to become active and involved. So if you go on to the Facebook group, you can sign the petition, you can learn what else you can do to help out. So, you know, listeners are in a real position to contribute to the betterment of these animals. And certainly what we do good for salamanders is going to be good for a myriad of other species as well.
Great, Matt. So again, we just go on Facebook, search for Save the Salamanders. And when you get on that page, the petition's right there at the top. So Matt, thanks for taking the time to fill us in on this important matter.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, take care now. Bye-bye. I want you to let you know that as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD. We'll get to that in a moment here on Talking Animals. Right now, it's time for a little bit of animal news and announcements, starting with In Defense of Animals. The International Animal Protection Organization released its annual list of the 10 worst zoos for elephants as of 2014. And this is the 11th year they've done that. And there's a quote here that says, IDA's 2014 list spotlights zoos representing the most appalling conditions for elephants, emphasizing an extended and egregious history of disregard for elephant care standards and science, said Tony Frohoff, PhD, elephant and cetacean scientist for IDA. Conservation cannot be used as an excuse for cruelty, especially when we know that elephants bred in captivity will not be released to the wild. Tens of millions of dollars spent keeping elephants in zoos could be used more wisely and compassionately for real conservation. So we're not going to run down the whole list, although it's easy to search for, again, indefensive animals, the 10 worst zoo list. But I am going to note that new to the list, number 10 slot, Disney's Animal Kingdom. Yeah, and it says Disney's Animal Kingdom has made some not-so-magical decisions for its elephants that have resulted in tragic deaths. In July, pregnant Moyo and her unborn calf died as a result of birth complications after being shipped from Disney's Animal Kingdom to the National Elephant Center in Florida. Zoos generally do not transfer pregnant females because of the great stress of travel and potential complications, yet they trucked Moyo, who also reportedly had a rare hormonal issue, to this unproven Florida center. We acknowledge another loss of a young elephant, Tufani, a 10-year-old young male who died from salmonella infection, a difficult illness to treat, and on and on. Not so Magic Kingdom there. This comes to us from our friend, Dr. Jennifer Conrad, been on the show a number of times as a major issue on this show. We always talk about pet declawing. There's a Manhattan Assemblywoman, Linda Rosenthal, who is trying to stop the pet declawing in that state and has introduced a measure that would be the state's nation's first statewide ban on cat declawing. So you can search that. Linda Rosenthal, again, trying to outlaw cat declawing all across New York. And I'm sure you probably saw, it was everywhere yesterday, about the dog that takes his bus on his own to the dog park. So if not, search for that. There's stories, there's blogs, there's everything. And I think we're just unfortunately out of time for any more animal news announcements for today. So I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway, but please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. There'll be a prize, a copy of the Talking Animals Anniversary Bash CD, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. It's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals. Take any guesses that come in off the air, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. I'll be back next Wednesday, January 21st, our first show at our new time, once again, of 10 a.m., 1 hour later, starting next week and thereafter. I hope you visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, archives, podcasts, etc. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, Twitter feed, and more. Hope you'll also consider subscribing to our email newsletter, find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand, and other important news from the Talking Animals universe. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Alternative Radio is next on WMNF. We might even try to squeeze in one guest. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Is it Year of the Cat?
It sure is.
Duncan, this is Shannon Rogers.
What's that?
This is Shannon Rogers.
Hey, Shannon. Wow. All right, cool. Well, congratulations. Stay on hold. We'll get you set up in a sec. Congratulations.
Okay.
Thanks. It was indeed Year of the Cat. So anyway, we'll be back next Wednesday, of course, another edition of Talking Animals at 10 a.m., an hour later from now on. And again, this is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki Wachee, and beyond, community conscious radio. Thanks for listening. Take care. See you next week.